This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Stephen Vogel looks at a leaf, he sees a whole world. He thinks about how a leaf deals with extreme temperatures of summer or high winds of a thunderstorm. And he decided to share his thoughts in a book that tells the story of nature and Stephen's love of science. The book is called The Life of a Leaf, and Stephen Vogel is professor emeritus in biology at Duke University, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Delighted to be here.
Steve, tell us about the genesis. What's behind this book?
Well, what's behind it is a lot of both personal history and the oddities of people I've interacted with. I've always been interested in the whole world of my sort of immediate perception. You know, never mind molecules or astronomical distances. It's the stuff right around me. That's one part of it. Another part is I fell into a bit of science called biomechanics, comparative biomechanics, which looks at this world. It worries about, you know, why when you go slowly you walk, when you go fast you run. Why don't trees usually blow over? And immediate questions like that. And then I discovered science museums, or they discovered me, because I was in an area which lent itself to hands-on exhibits. And then finally I got involved with some people who were trying to rework physics courses to be appropriate for life science students by incorporating biological material and so forth. And then I also was writing books, textbooks and things like that. So a whole bunch of pieces came together, and I thought I'd give this thing a try.
And what made you think the leaf would be the way we could explore these questions?
Well, I wanted something that was immediate, ubiquitous. I was a little scared about animals because I would immediately get into locomotion and a level of complexity which I think I could deal with, but I'm not sure anyone else would want to deal with the product.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, I've worked on leaves. I was in a zoology department, and being a sort of a curmudgeonous short, I'd sneak off and work on leaves. I looked at, in about 1970, what happened to leaves when the wind died and they started really getting hot, where it's, you know, 98 degrees out, and I got measurements on an oak leaf. It's 125 degrees. I mean, it's sitting there in the sun, absorbing light. It's its business. But, light's a mixed blessing when the sun's beating down on you. And then about 1990, there was a big wind tunnel in our department built for bird flight. And I thought, well, I'll put some leaves in the wind tunnel, see what they do. Wow. They reoriented in ways that just got their drag way, way down, totally unlike flags. I started, these are really clever designs. These are helping to keep the tree from blowing over in the storm. Leaves in a wind do just wonderful reorientation stunts. You don't see it because they thrash about in a storm. But once you've seen it in the wind tunnel or in pictures, as I put in the book, then with binoculars you can see it on real leaves. Or, of course, you can put one on a stick and stick it out of the window of your car. Because, again, we're talking about, you know, everyday phenomena. So that all of these things, you know, sort of got together.
But you're doing the basic stuff of science that we sometimes forget when we get into the vocabulary of science.
Yes.
That can be off-putting to those of us who can't kind of keep all of the
yes,
terms straight. But you asked this question, essentially, why don't leaves fly off the trees when the wind blows?
Yes. Yeah, right? This is absolutely real science.
Yeah.
This is not watered down or anything else, for better or worse. But it's the science you can do yourself. Again, you want to see what happens to a leaf in a storm, you put it on the end of a stick and you stick it out the window of your car and you see what happens.
You ask the question. This, and I was embarrassed actually because I loved the fact that for most of my childhood, I would ask questions that would, the answer to which was ask your mother, ask the priest. It was always find somebody else because nobody could answer. I never asked essentially, and I don't think this is the question you ask in the book, why don't trees get sunburned? But you, as you said, heat is a mixed blessing. Too much of it can, and we find ways to shed and reflect heat. How do trees do it? And you found that, yeah, we all know that is, now I know it's the leaf.
Yeah, and they've got, you know, a whole series of clever tricks, rejecting any wavelengths of light that they can't actually use. If you take pictures of a forest with infrared sensitive film, it comes out white. The leaves just reflect the infrared. They don't want any part of that stuff. It's just not energetically enough to use for photosynthesis. So I went out and got some infrared film and took some pictures and put them in there. And a lot of the shapes of leaves, the scalloping on oak leaves, all that scalloping and lobing turns out, and it's a fairly direct thing to show in the laboratory, keeps it from getting still hotter. I mean, they get hot, but they would get a lot hotter without some of these wonderful devices.
Are they also transmitting some of the heat from, I mean, are they in a sense,
yes.
Is that what, like the, what a dog does when it pants?
It's, absolutely doing this. You know, the for anything that gets hot and stays hot, the heat output, the energy output has to be the same as the energy input. So they are evaporating water, which they laboriously draw up the trunk, I mean, pump up 100 feet and evaporate the stuff. They're re-radiating to the sky a fair bit of energy. And they're coupling into the air with these sort of convection currents that you see sometimes up above the hot burner in a stove. You see, you look through it, and you see that the background sort of shimmers. And what you're looking at is this updraft, and exactly the same updraft occurs on top of a leaf on a hot day when the wind dies.
Is it all a matter of shape and design, or is there some mechanics and physics and chemistry that goes on to also help shed?
Not as much chemistry, but it's all physics. It's the physics of heat transfer. I mean, I keep a book on my shelf by a colleague, Adrian Bajan, called Heat Transfer, and I make considerable use of it because he talks at a level that I, as a biologist, can actually understand. It is all physics. And in fact, this is really a book about physics or about the physics of your immediate world with the leaf as a protagonist.
Well, let's talk about the oak leaf pizza, because that to me is the great discovery.
Oh, I see. Yes. Yes. And that's good fun. There's a kind of pizza. Well, first of all, the oak leaf's got all these scallops and lobes, which keeps it from getting even hotter. They couple it in to the air, and they basically allow this convective air cooling to be better than it would otherwise be. Well, I read about a pizza. Was recommended to me. It was a rising crust pizza that you put right on the oven rack, not on a tray. And I cooked up one.
And you take it, and it's right out of the freezer, right? So
right
from
out of
the freezer into the oven.
Put it in the oven, right on the oven grid. And I cooked one up, and it was okay, but it was soggy in the middle and overcooked on the edges. And I thought, well, that's the problem of an oak leaf on the tree or any other leaf with the sun beating down. The edges are well coupled to air temperature, and the middle is in real trouble because of all this stagnant air built up. And I said, well, okay, it's the same problem with the pizza, except, of course, with the pizza. It's cold and the airflow is downward, but that shouldn't matter. I could make an oak leaf-shaped pizza, and it would be better. And then I thought, no, this is stupid. That's a lot of work to make an oak leaf-shaped pizza. Let me do something the oak leaf can't do. I'll put a hole in the middle. It'll accomplish the same thing, but oak leaves, which have to develop, you know, outward, by the way they grow, can't easily make a hole. So I put a 3-inch hole in the middle of the pizza. Cook the hole, too, of course. Pizza cooks in 2/3 of the time, and it's much more uniform. I wrote a letter to the company, but I didn't get an answer.
But, the book is called Cooking with Steve Vogel. No, the book is The Life of a Leaf.
The Life of a Leaf. So the biomimetic pizza.
That's fantastic. So you learn something from the oak leaf. And is it – what about the makeup of the leaf itself? Not only the shape, which helps to radiate heat, is there something in the skin of the leaf that also reflects – obviously must reflect radiation?
There is, but I don't know that there's been very much specifically done on what is it about the leaf, for instance, that makes it – that gives it these interesting optical properties. But I don't think that's been well investigated. Mm. The phenomenon is well known. In fact, it was discovered here in Durham by Dwight Billings in the botany department at Duke back in the early 1950s. And it's not anything obscure. But the mechanistic basis of it seems not to have attracted any particular attention. You know, what science we do is a lot of it's sort of the accident of who gets interested in what. And there's considerable amount of fashion involved and so forth.
And part of it is we've known some of the things we've known the effects for so long, we never bothered to ask the reasons. Your mother and her friends always could tell the temperature just by looking at rhododendron leaves.
Yeah, they curl up, and the tighter the colder the morning in the winter, the tighter the curl and the more coats you have to put on the kid. And
what's going on there?
What's going on there? This is a little more speculative, but first of all, the sun heats up leaves, and it's a point source. The clear sky will cool things down. But it's a distributed sink. The sky is all across the sky. And so a leaf on a cold morning sticking out, it's got trouble. It can get considerably colder than the air around it. I have measurements on magnolia leaves where the air temperature is 18. This was a couple of winters ago. And I got leaves down to minus 4.
Mm.
Well, the rhododendron leaf seems to have a trick. It first of all, it droops down vertically, which must reduce its solar exposure. And then it curls up into a tight little curl, which, you know, the colder it is, the tighter it gets. And probably it is doing so by ice crystals forming in just the right place, because you can try it yourself. Just take a rhododendron leaf, put it in your food freezer, and real fast, it curls up quite nicely. But I think what's happening is it's an anti-chimney. The leaf is below local temperature, and so the air inside it is below local temperature, so it goes downward, and more air is drawn in from the top, through the top opening, and that keeps it, that air movement down through it keeps it from getting colder still.
Ah, so it's a kind of a convection trick.
It's a convection trick, yeah. Except it's the opposite of what we do with the chimney. It's an anti-chimney. And we might actually, you know, it's possible you could build cooling devices for houses where at night, on clear nights where you had them, you created such an anti-chimney and stored cold air in somewhere down in rocks in your basement to be blown up during the day. I'm not sure. That's the level of engineering as opposed to biology, and I'm not really an engineer.
I want to be invited to your house. We'll have the anti-chimney, and we'll have the rhododendron pizza. We'll just pull a couple leaves out of the freezer, put them on your donut pizza. You know, you talked about ice and the fact that you speculate that perhaps the manipulation of ice crystals within the leaf of the rhododendron is the mechanism that allows this folding to take place. Ice is really kind of a destructive force in the world, isn't it?
Yeah. In fact, in the book, and it just occurred to me, so I put the phrase in because one loves to make a phrase, that water in the solid state, ice, is the most widely distributed toxic substance on Earth. Well, organisms are fanatic in keeping ice from forming inside their cells, to keeping ice crystals extracellular. Apparently, ice within a cell is just death. Even so, and you put a carrot in your refrigerator, the carrot is not the same afterwards. It gets, sway-backed. Ice is tricky stuff, and there are a lot of, these plants can't hide. And these leaves are getting very, very cold, and there's a lot of ice in them. Now, they make antifreezes. They have all kinds of tricks there. And it's not just the ice. When water freezes, a lot of dissolved gas comes out. There's a lot of air in cold water, mostly. It freezes, comes out. It's very hard to make ice cubes that aren't cloudy. That's the air coming out. And those air bubbles are also destructive and tear things up. By the way, if you want, you can make clear icicles. They come out clear, but ice cubes come out cloudy.
Now, why is that?
What? Well, the icicles freeze outward, and the air is forced outward. Into the atmosphere, whereas ice cubes freeze inward, and they're always cloudiest in the middle.
So from the outside in, it's forcing the air in
further, and finally you get those bubbles in the middle.
So then the plant needs to figure out a way to force that air out.
And to keep it out of the cells, that's the main thing. Plants, of course, are wildly variable in their tolerance for ice. Our daffodils grew up in the spring. They've just started to come up now, and they can take quite a freeze, and somehow they're able to deal with the ice crystals, or else they produce, I don't know specifically, I suspect they make a lot of use of antifreeze proteins and things like that to keep really big ice crystals from forming and make sure the ice crystals don't form until you get really, really cold and they're not really good ice crystals. Antifreezes are wonderful.
How does that work? How do they create antifreeze?
Same way they create anything else. Plants are fabulous chemists. That's why so many of our pharmaceuticals come from plants. And they're all different classes of antifreeze. I mean, we put ethylene glycol into cars, and I think some plants make those. Another common substance to be used is glycerol, which is a slightly sweet kind of thing. It tastes a little bit like a liquid sugar. That's a common antifreeze. I know that there's some fishes that use this. I don't really know if the plants do.
And is it just the shape of the molecule then that just busts up that water crystal?
I'm not – now, there you're getting into the molecular stuff, and I'm not real good at that. But somehow they are able to keep the crystals either from forming entirely or keep the crystals from forming – from getting very large. Proteins are used as well. And I think glycerol in particular turns out to scavenge gas, so it helps prevent ice bubble formation. So it's particularly good, and I don't know about the rest of them. Again, I've nothing against chemistry, but I just haven't devoted much of my life to looking into it. I took a lot of chemistry courses in college, but somehow I ended up asking questions that were more in mechanical engineering than chemistry.
And part of the impetus behind this book, too, was your sense that we do have a far too siloed kind of education when it comes to science. And it's precisely the sort of the mechanics and the physics and the chemistry that aren't always brought together until the higher levels that allow us, in many ways, we start to feel excluded as lay people very quickly if one of these silos isn't for us.
Yeah. Yes. And also in teaching it, we like to create a storyline. Start with the simple and move up. But the storyline we create, and biology is perhaps the worst offender, starts with things you can't see, molecules, atoms, and so forth, and builds up from there. Whereas I think what you have to do is you have to start with your immediate world. This is what draws you in to science, not as revealed truth, but as a way of thinking. You know, this is why we're also worrying about physics courses now. You know, where do you start? Well, physics is even more hierarchical in a way because you really do have to start with the Newtonian laws and things like that. I mean, there's no escaping them. But you have to put them in the context of one's everyday experience. And then the stuff starts meaning something to you.
And it's hard to experience a multiverse.
Yes.
At least for me.
Yes. And yeah. And the question is, you know, what should we teach first? Well, the answer is everything. Well, obviously.
But you knew something. You're a scholar. You look into mechanics, the mechanics of biology. You've ascended to this level in the academy, and then you take on this project. And I'm wondering if you were surprised by anything. What did you learn in putting this book together?
Well, for one thing, I've gotten to where I can write about things that I don't know very much about until I start digging into the literature. Then I get them written down. Then I put them out of my mind and try to do something else. So I learned a great deal about the physics of radiant heat exchange, which I hadn't known very much about. I learned a fair amount of botany. I'm not much of a botanist. I had to learn about leaves that had drip tips and things like that. And you always learn a little bit about writing, or at least you hope you do. What I did, it may strike you as odd, I got involved with the local science book club that meets once a month over at the local Barnes & Noble. And there are about eight people that get there, and it's a highly disorganized thing and kind of fun. And everybody else is sitting there arguing about books. And, well, I'm there, too, arguing about books. But I'm also listening with a different ear. I'm listening to how these people respond to books and thinking, okay, they don't like it to be too glib. They're willing to work fairly hard. It's important to put a sign over your desk that says, explain, damn it, don't just mention.
Mm-hmm.
People are not happy when you just mention and sling terms at them. You know, that's that. I think some of what I learned watching this or listening in on the Science Book Club was quite surprising. I just hadn't thought in those terms before. You know, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool academic, a teacher. You go in, you give a lecture, you have notes in front of you and so forth and give exams. You write a book for people like this. You're interacting with people in quite a different way.
Well, it's great to talk with you. A lot of fun to talk about all of this, Steve. Thanks for being on the program.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Stephen Vogel, Professor Emeritus in Biology at Duke University. The new book is called The Life of a Leaf. Just ahead, we will follow the travails and triumphs of Geek Mom. Stay tuned.